session. I wanted to thank you first for all what you did. It was a very inspiring experience for me to teach in front of you, and it was sometimes challenging because you are challenging people, bright and challenging people. So I hope I have challenged you too. And thank you again. And so this time I wanted to introduce you to a subject in a sort of relaxed way, to talk about random matrices, because random matrices is a subject I've been working on various times of my life. And it's a subject which is at the interface between math, physics, statistics, biology, and which is perhaps one of the example of the what is called, it's Wigner, I think, we thought about the success on the unreasonable success of mathematics. And so what are random matrices? Let me first show you just something which always amazes me. No. Why is it? Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's not this one. I'm sorry, I'm using Mathematica, and here I should be using Maple. But I will be considering a random complex matrix. So I will be considering a matrix, an n by n matrix. See, I've taken a large n by n matrix, complex, okay, like that. And I'm only considering that each entry, let's say mij, is some x plus iy with x and y completely random numbers. For instance, here I have taken random numbers between minus 1 and 1. Okay, and so we have a huge, and n will be considering as large, the size of the matrix. And we are interested, for various reasons, into the distribution of the eigenvalues. Okay, we are looking at the eigenvalues of the matrix. Eigenvalues, okay? Because usually the eigenvalues contains a lot of information about the matrix. If the matrix was an Hamiltonian, well, it's a complex matrix, so it's not an Hermitian Hamiltonian, but if the matrix was an Hamiltonian, the eigenvalues are the energy level of the system. Okay. And so here is what I did last time, but that's a three-line program which computes, or in fact, the one-line program which computes, which makes a random complex n by n matrix. Here the size of the matrix is 10. And let us run the program. So, okay, here is one random matrix. Here is a spectrum. So you see, in principle, there are 10 dots, which represent the 10 complex eigenvalues in the complex plane. This is the origin. And they are, you see here, they are located around the origin. And since the matrix is 10 by 10, they are around 0 and in between 0 and minus 1 and 1. Okay? So I have normalized, in fact, the matrix to be minus 1, 1 divided by the square of the size of the size of the matrix for reasons which will become clear together. Because if the size of the matrix becomes larger, you may have larger and larger eigenvalues. Okay? So now let us start to consider 100 by 100 eigenvalues. Okay, you have here now you have 100 eigenvalues, and they are located in the complex plane, and you start to see some structures. They are not everywhere. They do not, they are no here, etc. They are distributed evenly around the origin. Okay, and it's not an accident. Well, with 100 eigenvalues, it's not an accident, but you see, this is for another matrix. Okay, it still looks the same. Okay, another matrix. It looks similar. Now, let us go to 1,000 Eigen R, sorry. 1000. It takes some more time. Of course, it will. The program will crash. Murphy's law is there. Ah, here you are. Okay. And of course, I can repeat the operation, but you can feel that it's not just a coincidence. The eigenvalues are equally distributed with some average density, which is constant, inside a circle. You see? Okay. So, and all problems of eigenvalue have such kind of similarities. Of singularity. So now, for instance, now I shall consider a little bit the history of random matrices. In fact, random matrices were introduced first, as far as I know, by an English, a British statistician called Wishart. His name is here. So it was Wishart. And he was interested, he is one of the great statisticians from the British school in English school in the beginning of the first part of the and the second part of the well say the middle of the 20th century, and he was interested in finding in doing what was called multivariate analysis. So analysis of correlations between many variables. So I think he has been working with Fisher, one of the great statisticians and biologists, which has developed the theory of you know, of modern evolution theory out of Darwinism. He has been interested in imagine that you have a set of M input data, and out of that you have N output data, and with n less than m, and you want to look, you are interested in seeing whether there are correlations between the m initial data and the n output data. So, for instance, this is often used in the study of market shares now. It's because you may be interested in, you know, what the input data is, some data about the economical wealth, the activity, the gross products of some firms. And the N output data are the share values, okay, of some other firms. And you want to see, well, first, if there is a correlation between the activity of firms and the value of the share. Well, everybody knows that there is no relation at all, but let's just assume there is one. And so you are interested in, for instance, seeing if some firm goes better and sells more, if there is a correlation with the share of some other firm, because if they are connected and one needs the other to buy products, etc. So what you can do is that you can have now you can consider a large M times N matrix, which contains information at a given time between you measure correlation, and this value measures the you measure correlation, okay. You measure correlation, and you are interested to see if there is in those data something hidden, some information about the about the relation between this object hidden. So what you can do is that you have this big matrix, let us call it C, and what you are doing is that you are taking, in that case, this will be C dagger, well, C, the transpose of C times C, which is an N by N matrix. Okay, it's N by N. Okay, you take this matrix and you multiply it by this one. This is C, this is C dagger, this is transpose. Okay, and you look at its eigenvalue. Okay. And your question is there something hidden in the distribution of the eigenvalues of this matrix? Okay. Of course, this is a symmetric matrix. So the eigenvalues will be real. So we have to look at the distribution of the eigenvalues along the in the real plane. Okay, so here is what I've been doing there. Now, this one fell down. Okay, so now I am doing, I will be playing the same game with a matrix which will be, let us say, well, let us start with 40 times 20. Okay, so I have 40 input and 20 output, and I will compute the distribution. So this is the axis where the value of the eigenvalues, and here I am counting how many eigenvalues there are within a given interval on the axis of the value of the eigenvalue. So this will be a distribution for the eigenvalues, and the distribution of eigenvalues for a given matrix. And of course, what I will be doing is that we'll be playing the same game. I will try to see if there are no correlation at all, then I can take the element of C to be random variables, you see? And the idea is that if there are some correlation, they will show up in the distribution of eigenvalues as something different from what's happening when you have random variables. In fact, the interest of using random matrix is to see what's happening if there are no correlation at all, and out of this, if you see some signal coming on, it means that there are some correlation. That's the idea. Okay, so we are considering one of those variables, then those matrix, and I'm playing the same game. Okay, so I have seen something here. Okay, so you see there is something. The eigenvalues are concentrated around some interval. But it's not very clear what's happening because it's a small matrix. Okay. Now let us go to a larger matrix, like 200 by 400, and play the same game. Okay. Then you start to see that it's something more regular. It goes up very quickly and it ends up slowly. Okay. Let us do it again. Okay. You see that it's. Okay, it's not exactly the same distribution, but it's very similar. So you see some regularity emerging from this. Okay, so now here is, let us do it now with 200 by 800. You see the distribution is different, but it's still the same. So clearly, the distribution seems to differ from seems to depend on the ratio n over m. The distribution will depend on n over m. Okay, because if I take a distribution which is slightly different, like 100 divided by 4 and 400, well, I get a distribution which is quite similar to the previous one. There are more fluctuations because the matrix are smaller. Okay, and now if I make an average, so here for instance I will be taking 200 by 800 matrices, but I take 100 samples, so 100 completely independent matrices, and make the average, and in fact, I obtain this very regular curve, which is the average of a large number of distribution. So the distribution before for one random sample, and that's an average over samples. Okay. So that's an average over an ensemble of random matrices. Okay, and you get some nice curve, which is complete. Well, it's not completely obvious how to compute it, and if I try. This is the result of the calculation, but if I continue, I launch an average, it will take some time because I'm averaging over 100. Well, I think it will take some more time. Yes, it's run. Oh no, it's finished. No, it's finished. So now you see, it's really regular. Okay. So now, well, initially, in the story of random vortices, in fact, we physicists are considering that random vortices, the history of random vortices, starts in 51 when Wigner. So this was, I think, in 1928. But in 1951, Eugene Wigner, the famous Wigner, had the idea that if you have a very complicated quantum system, in fact, I think he was interested in a spectrum of atomic nuclei. You see, so heavy nuclei made out of many protons and many neutrons are complicated objects. At that time, nobody had a real good understanding of what was going on inside the nuclei, what was the nature of the strong force. It's still very, very difficult to study now. But therefore, people were developing a phenomenological model where they assumed that you had protons, neutrons, and you had some force gluing them together, and they were developing non-relativistic quantum mechanical model of this kind. So the one model was a shell model, which was assuming that basically you had an effective potential, and you had your nuclei and interacting, and there were energy level distributed according to some kind of Bohr-like theory. There were other models developed later on, like the liquid droplet model, fluid models, etc. But the question was, if you have a complicated model with a complicated system with complicated interaction between many degrees of freedom, the position of the nuclei, of the neutron and the proton, can you say something about the typical spectrum of the theory? So is there some what are the properties of spectrum, of the spectrum of a complex quantum system? Okay. So complex means that it's a system with no conservation law. You know, for instance, the spectrum of the hydrogen atom or the spectrum of the harmonic oscillator is very regular and very simple because there are symmetry laws for the hydrogen atom. It's because in addition to the rotation invariance, the O3 group of rotation, you have a force symmetry group, which is hidden, which is called the Lorentz, the Lenz, associated to the Lenz vector. So it's the Lenz vector in the vector in the hydrogen atom. Okay, so there is somewhere hidden in the hydrogen atom or in the 1/8 potential of the problem. There is some symmetry. If you have a complex system with complicated integration, you have no symmetries but for eventually, you know, of course, the conservation of energy and the rotation invariance, and that's it. And therefore, you may ask, what are the typical properties of the system? And Wigner suggested that instead of looking at the solution of the Schrödinger equation like H psi equal E psi, for psi, complicated Hamiltonian. Okay, let us take as a complicated Hamiltonian a random matrix, a random Hermitian or a random symmetric matrix. Because if the system is very, very complicated, you can say after all the matrix element of the Hamiltonian between the a basis of states we start from are somehow random. Okay? And Dyson, the famous Dyson, in fact, studied this in the beginning of the 60s. And I'm sorry, I'm showing the answer, but he played with the same game with a symmetric random matrix. So I'm taking now a symmetric random matrix with entries which are in between -1 and +1. I'm taking a 10 by 10 matrix, and I am here. This is a number of eigenvalues which are in a given interval. So here you have 10 intervals, and I think I am dividing in 20 intervals. So basically, there are one or less than one eigenvalues in an interval. So it's not something very regular. But you see, these are the, this means that there is one eigenvalue here, one eigenvalue here, one eigenvalue here, etc. Okay, I'm counting the number of eigenvalues. So this is for a small Hamiltonian, a system with 10 quantum states. Okay. Now let us go to a system with 100 different states possible. Okay, and here you see that it starts to become the eigenvalues. Here you have one eigenvalues, three, four eigenvalues, etc. You see that there are more eigenvalues, more energy levels concentrated. Well, this is in fact the origin, because the distribution is between 0 and 1. So in fact, this is the origin in terms of eigenvalues. The eigenvalues are equally distributed according to some law. Okay? So this is basically the density of eigenvalues in an energy interval. The density of level, energy level of the system in a given energy interval. Okay? And now let us go to 1,000. What's going on? How it's running? Okay. It starts to be more regular because you have many, many more eigenvalues. And in fact, if you look a bit carefully, you recover that this will be a half a circle. This is, in fact, slightly squashed like that. This is an ellipse. So this is half a circle. And this is a famous law, which is called the Dyson semicircle law, which means that the density of eigenvalue of a random symmetric matrix is form a semicircle. Okay? And now if I make an average, I play the same game, but I make an average over over many, many independent random matrices. So I am taking here 100 independent random symmetric matrix of size 400. And I'm averaging. This is the average density, and it's a neat semicircle, you see. And I can start it again. Let us start the simulation again. And as expected, we'll see that it was not a coincidence. Right. It takes some time. Okay. So let us this computer compute quietly, and I will discuss. Take some time. Okay. So okay, here it is. Here, the semicircle was built in front of your eyes, and so it didn't cheat. Okay? Of course, you have checked that the program is correct. Okay? Now, now remember, I have always been using up to now a system where the entries of the matrix M, A, I, G, here it's a symmetric. Are random numbers between minus 1 and 1. And you may ask, that's fine, but does it depend on the form of the distribution? So now here I have been taking a random symmetric matrix where the entry are not random numbers between minus 1 and plus 1, but the entries are random plus or minus 1. Just plus or minus 1. And I get the same distribution, the same semicircle law. Okay? So you can take random minus 1 plus 1. You can also take, and that's usually what people are doing, Gaussian random variables with variance of order 1. So instead of taking the IG to be random, you take the IG distributed with a probability law, P for the probability to have IG is proportional to exponential minus IAG squared, okay, with some normalization, okay. And it works as well. You obtain always the same distribution. So you see there is really universality. This, some universality is appearing in the behavior of the eigenvalues in ensemble of random matrices. Yes?
For, and that's for any distribution?
That's basically, this will be true for any distribution provided that it has a finite variance for a large matrix. But what is important is that the AIG has to be independent. Okay? If the AIG, the element of the matrix, there are correlations between the different elements, then the law will be different. And many, many interesting problems occur when you have correlation between the AIG. But the problem becomes more difficult. Okay? So here I am taking completely independently distributed random elements for the matrix. Okay. Okay, so I will stop there for the moment. And what is the connection of this problem, which is now a very classical problem, with, for instance, a field theory, statistical mechanics? Okay. So one relation is a mathematical one. It is that in order to understand, for instance, why you obtain this distribution law, or why you obtain this beautiful circle in the case of random complex matrices. In fact, you know, the best way to understand why this happened is to use the tools we have, I have explained to you, when quantizing gauge theories, which is gauge fixing. So let me explain what's happening. I take matrix AIG, which is random. I will take, for simplicity, I will take a random. I can take a random complex matrix. Okay. So A is a random complex matrix, which means that each AIG is random. So this means that each element AIG is XIG plus IYG, okay? And XIG and YIG are independent random variables. So let us take, for simplicity, a Gaussian distribution for it. So I mean that the probability to have the probability distribution for XIG will be exponential minus AIG squared. The probability distribution for YIG will be exponential minus this X, of course, YIG squared. Okay? And, okay, so then what is the probability distribution for having a matrix A? A given matrix A with such element. It will be the product of the each. So it will be simply the products for each element of the matrix of P of XIG, P of YIG. Okay? And of course, this is a product of exponential of squares. So this is the exponential of the sum of the squares. And so this can be written as the exponential of a sum of minus the sum of IG. So the sum of all the n. So here we have n squared element of XIG squared plus YIG squared. And this you can rewrite very easily in compact form, which is minus the trace of the matrix A times its adjoint. Okay? So, and here you see that in fact the distribution probability for the matrices, this is the probability distribution over complex n by n matrices. Okay, of course, I and g goes from 1 to n. Okay? So this. So here you see that the probability distribution has some hidden invariance. Because if I change A into U dagger A V, where U and V are unitary matrices, so they belong to UN, where N is the size of the matrix, N by N matrices, the probability distribution doesn't change. Okay, so there is UN, if you want left cross UN right invariance, hidden in the problem. Left means that this is, I multiplied the left, the matrix by a UN, a unitary matrix, and I multiply by a completely independent UN matrices to the right of the matrix. So there is a UN cross UN invariance in the problem. It's not a gauge invariance, it's just a global, this is one matrix, but it's, there is an invariance hidden in the problem, okay? And you can check that, of course, when you have to do, you have a measure over the, you have a measure, this is a probability distribution, but in fact, you have also a product over I, G of D, X, I, G, D, Y, I, G, and this measure, in fact, so the full probability distribution is given by this measure, measure of probability, okay? And this probability measure is in fact this measure of probability, which is invariant under this UN cross UN invariance. Okay? So now, perhaps I will remove this for a few minutes. So now, what I am interested is computing the eigenvalue distribution of the distribution of eigenvalues for random matrices which are distributed according to a probability law, which is dA. I will write this dA as the integration measure of n by n complex matrices. So I remember n by n complex matrices have 2 times n squared independent real entries. Okay, you have n squared xij independent and n squared yij independent. So complex matrices have n squared independent complex entries, so they have 2 times n squared independent real entries. Okay? And I have to compute exponential of minus 1/2 trace of A times ADAG. Okay? Okay. And I have this invariance, which I have to use. And of course, the distribution of eigenvalues is invariant under this transformation. If I made this transformation on the matrix, the eigenvalue will not change. Because it's just a change, or they will change perhaps by a phase, but that's okay. So what I have to compute is, so I would like then to use this invariance to reduce the number of the integration over the 2 n squared variables under the, I want to reduce, to use this invariance to reduce this to the 2 n independent eigenvalues. Okay? And I know that for any A complex matrices, there exists a U and a V such that A equal U dagger lambda V, where lambda is a diagonal matrix with element lambda 1 lambda n, which are the eigenvalues. So this is a matrix of the form lambda 1, lambda 1, 0, 0, which these are the eigenvalues, eigenvalues of A. Okay? Good. So I can use a trick of gauge fixing integration to say I have an integral, I have a complicated integral over 2 times n squared independent variables, but this integral has a un cross un invariance. Okay, un left cross un right, if you want. Okay, and so what I can do is to make a gauge transformation for each in order to always transform any matrix into a diagonal matrix. Okay? So in order to do that, I will fix a gauge. Fix a gauge condition. Okay? What will be the gauge condition? Of course, the gauge condition will be that all the non-diagonal elements of the matrix are zero. So I will get a fixed gauge condition, which will be, I will fix, in fact, 2 times n squared minus 2n gauge condition, which are that real parts that if I is different from g, the real part of aig is equal to 0, and the imaginary part of aig is equal to 0. Okay? So when I have an integral like that, I can transform this integral, let us call it I, into an integral of the form, integral over dA. These products over I different of g of those delta function of, well, let us write it ig, well, xig, real part of aig times delta of imaginary part of aig for ei different from g. And then I will have a Fadeyev Popov determinant. Okay. And then I will have the exponent, the term I want to integrate. But now, if I do, I'm fixing this gauge condition, of course, what remains is the diagonal elements of the matrix. Okay? And what did I have? I have an exponential 1/2 trace of A times A dagger. Okay? So if I fix this gauge condition, what remains in the integration over the dii products for all the I of the dai, exponential minus 1/2 of, but now if the matrix is diagonal, what is trace of ai at times a dagger? It's just the sum of the diagonal elements of the modulus of the diagonal elements. So something which is sum over I of aii squared. Okay? And in addition, of course, because of this gauge condition, the aii is equal to the I eigenvalue of the matrix. Okay? So now, what remains to be understood is what is the Fadeyev-Popov determinant? Okay? So, what is the Fadeyev-Popov determinant? I won't do the calculation because this is the last lecture, so I'm tired. But it's a simple exercise to compute the Fadeyev-Popov determinant, and you found that it is simply the product of all the I. So I will consider here just I, the pairs I, g, so the I less than g of the I eigenvalue times the g eigenvalue, the modulus of this to the power, I think, 4. Because I'm doing with a complex matrix, yes. Okay. So this is a very simple. It's a product of all pairs of different eigenvalues of the modulus of the difference between those two eigenvalues. Okay. So now let us rewrite this integral in terms of an integral of eigenvalues. What we have with this calculation, this result, is that we can rewrite this as this integral, we can rewrite it as an integral of the products over the n eigenvalues. And remember that the n eigenvalues belong to the complex plane. They are complex numbers. So I am integrating over n times the complex plane. I have this determinant times this term. And let us rewrite it. Let us rewrite this determinant as the exponential of logarithm. I have an exponential of minus sum over I less than g. There will be a factor 4. I'm not completely sure whether this factor is 4 or 2. So I think it's 4, but it's not very important for what we are going to do. Logarithm of the distance between those of the modulus, this is the modulus between the 2 points. And then I have a minus times minus. Here I will write this like that for reason which will become clear. Plus 1/2 sum over I lambda I modulus square. Okay? So I am integrating over all position of the particle in the complex plane. I have a set of points to each point is associated a lambda I and a lambda g. Okay? And what is this? This is a partition function. You can view this as a partition function in the sense of thermostatistical mechanics. Of a gas of n points with this position, lambda I on the complex plane. You see, you have this is a complex plane, and to each eigenvalue there is a point on the complex plane, and this you can view this as the exponential of minus the energy of the configuration. And what is the energy? The energy contains two terms. It contains a term which is lambda I square, which tells you that if this is the origin, zero, this point has an energy which is proportional to the distance to the origin. Okay? So these points are inside an harmonic potential. Okay? There is just a force which is proportional to the distance to the origin with a rotational invariance. And what is this for? This is a force which is proportional to minus, you have a potential which is minus the logarithm of the distance between two different points. And what is this? So this means that there is an energy which is proportional to the distance. And it's decreasing. This energy is, in fact, decreasing with the distance. So there is a repulsion between 2 points. But what is a force which is minus log of lambda I minus lambda g? This is just the Coulomb potential. Coulomb potential in 2 dimensions. Okay? You know that the Coulomb potential in 3 dimensions is in 1/r. But the Coulomb potential is 2 dimensions, is in minus logarithm. Okay? So this means simply that you have a gas of n charged particles with the same charge, so they repel each other, in a potential, in an harmonic potential. So we have n charged particles which repel each other and which are in an harmonic potential. Okay? So we have transformed the problem of integrating matrices into a problem of classical thermodynamics. You have a gas of charged particle. This is called the Coulomb gas. Okay. Here there is a temperature which is of unity, so the temperature is one. It's normalized to one. And what you are interested in is simply finding the equilibrium distribution of a gas of particle in an of a gas of charged particle in an harmonic potential in two dimensions. So you have now a problem, following problem. You have an harmonic potential, but it's in two dimensions. You have a set of charged particles, so those particles would like to repel each other. And you are looking at the equilibrium distribution. Okay? And now, when the number of particles is very large, in fact, you can treat the system of particles as a continuum system, a continuum gas, a liquid, if you want, a continuum system. Okay? And you can look at the solving the equation of electrostatics in such a configuration. And what you found is that, indeed, in such a system, the density of this will be the density of charge. When n becomes very large, the equilibrium configuration is just that you have particles with a finite density here and no particle outside. So by this electrostatic analogy, in the large n limit, the number of large number of particles, what you recover is you recover why this the distribution of particles was a circle. This is because of this trick of using a gauge fixing condition. This was because of this invariance, un cross un. The transformation into a problem of electrostatic. We have a problem of electrostatic. Okay. And the fact that when n enlarge, in fact, you see that here you have a term which is of order n squared. Here you have a term which is of order n. But if you rescale the eigenvalue so that this becomes of order n, in the large n limit, you just have to find the minimum of this configuration. So you transform a problem of thermodynamics into a problem of electrostatics when n is large. And the solution of this problem of electrostatics is a fluid of charged particle with a finite and constant density inside a circle, and then it drops and it's zero. Okay, so this explains why the distribution of eigenvalues of a large random complex matrix is a system of equally distributed eigensystem inside a circle. It's in fact explained by the solution of problem of two-dimensional electrostatics. Okay? So now let us come back to our random matrix. Wigner, in fact, was interested in the properties of the spectrum of complex systems like atomic nuclei. And when you are looking at properties of atomic nuclei, you are not interested exactly in the density of. Here is the energy. Okay, and you have a set of level. And in fact, in such a complicated system, if you plot the density of states as a function of energy, in fact, we have seen that for the random matrix model, this was a circle. But for a complicated system, like a real atomic nuclei, this is something which is more complicated, something like that. So the fact that the density of eigenvalues of the density of states is a circle, is a very nice mathematical result, but it doesn't contain any information for the physics of a complex system. What contains some information about the physics of the system are the correlation between the distance of eigenvalues. So Wigner was interested into the distribution law for the distance or the spacing between successive eigenvalues, namely energy level. Okay. So in fact, here you have an energy in a given interval of energy. You know that you have dE times rho of E energy levels. Okay. But you are, so in average you expect that the average distance between successive energy level will be our order, of course, 1/ρe. Okay. So and I am interested in. I'm interested at the distribution, in fact, of, let us say, if I have an energy level here, I have the successive level, which is E plus dE. Okay. And I am interested in the distribution of dE times rho of E, where dE is the distance between two energy level at energy close to E. Okay, so I take an energy level which has an energy E. I looked at the next energy level. It has an energy E plus dE. I multiply by rho E to have something which is equally distributed wherever I'm here, or here. And I want to look at the if there is something in the distribution between energy level. Okay? And that's what Wigner has been doing. Of course. Ah, great. And then okay, so here I am taking a system of size, for instance, I am taking a symmetric matrix, and I am looking now at the distribution between successive energy level normalized, as I said. Okay, so the program is a little bit more complicated because I'm bad at programming. I'm sure it can be done in two lines, but okay, you see that. So what does this mean? It means that on the average for my system of energy level, there is one eigenvalue such that the next eigenvalue is very close to this one. There are six eigenvalues such that the distance between one eigenvalue and the next one is of order two. There are eight eigenvalues such that the distance between this eigenvalue is the next one is of order three. And this increase, there is a maximum when the distance between the eigenvalue as the next one is of order four with my normalization. And then the probability to have a large distance between two successive eigenvalues drops down because it cannot be too large because the density is of order one. So you see there is a maximum for the distance between successive eigenvalues. And it's come. The probability becomes close to zero if the distance is very small. It reaches a maximum, and then it becomes. And I can start again for another matrix. You see it's different. Still 100. Okay, so you see that it's. But if I go to a much larger matrix, which is a matrix 1,000 by 1,000. I do the calculation. It will take some time. I have something which looks more regular with less fluctuation. Let's hope. I continue for another sample. Okay, there are some fluctuations, but it looks like the same. And now I can make an average over independent symmetric matrices. And here I have something that I've been doing. So I do the same thing, but now I have computed the same thing for matrices which are 500 by 500, but I think I took 20 matrices, and I get something which is much smoother. Okay? And this distribution is known as the energy, as the the Wigner law of spacing between eigenvalues in random matrix models. And this, in fact, this curve will still be universal. So it will not depend on the detail of the random matrix. In fact, this law depends on one thing. So you get a distribution law like that. If I'm looking at the, so this is the spacing between eigenvalues, and this is the density of spacing between eigenvalues, and you get a function like that, which is called the Wigner distribution. Okay. And in fact, the form of this curve is really universal. It doesn't depend on the specific set of random Hamiltonian you are taking, of random matrices. But it depends on one important parameter. Okay. If you take symmetric real matrices, you get one curve. If you take Hermitian complex matrices, you get a curve which is slightly different. In fact, what you get is that a distribution which is linear in the case of real. You get a distribution which is, I think, like a square in the case of Hermitian complex matrices. And there is a third set of random matrices which you can define, which are called symplectic random matrices, which you encounter in some problems. Okay. Symplectic random matrices, and for them, you have a curve which is still different. And the point is that, in fact, the density here behaves with delta E as delta E to a power, to some power, and beta is 1 for the real case, beta is 2 for the complex case, and beta is 4 for the symplectic case. Okay? Yes?
Is the symplectic case then related to quaternions? Or?
Yes. In fact, what is called symmetric real matrices are, in fact, symmetric matrices. So what is called symmetric matrices are symmetric matrices, are matrices over the real numbers. The case of complex matrices, we are dealing with matrices over C. And for symplectic matrices, you are dealing over symmetries over the quaternions. The field of quaternionic numbers. Yes?
Octonions?
No, octonions doesn't work because octonions are non-associative. And in fact, there are theorems which tell you that if you want to construct some quantum mechanical system, you need you can construct them over R, C, and H, but not over octonions, because octonions do not form an associative algebra. And associativity is related to causality, if you want. You know, associative means that if I measure A, then B, and then C, it's the same thing that measuring A, then B, then C. So it's some it's deeply rooted in the formalism of quantum mechanics. Okay. Now, this system, in fact, corresponds to, in general, standard quantum mechanics is based on the space of complex matrices, on complex Hilbert space. You end up with system with real Hamiltonians where you have a system which is T invariant. Invariant under time symmetry. So if a system is time reversal, so for instance, a system of particles in an electric field, it's time invariant. It's describing an Hamiltonian which can be made real. If a system is not time invariant, because when you change time, the dynamics is not the same. And that's a very simple system, is a charged particle in a magnetic field. You know, if you are in a magnetic field, if you change the time, the particle turns in the other side. You have to change both the direction of time and the sign of the magnetic field in order to have the same system. So that's the general system. And quaternionic corresponds to a system which is T invariant plus some SU2 symmetry, additional symmetry, which in fact one encounters in problems in condensed matter. In problem in condensed matter, there are often systems which have an additional SU2 symmetry. So for instance, if you have a system involving electrons in a crystal, but the electrons have a spin. They can have a spin up or a spin down. And if you have a symmetry, which is what's happening to the electrons where they have a spin up, and what's happening to the electron where we have the spin down, and in addition, if you have symmetry under time reversal, then the system can be described by an Hamiltonian, which in fact has an additional symmetry and can be written as an Hamiltonian over the quaternionic matrices. Okay? So this corresponds to a real physical system. It corresponds to a system with additional symmetries in addition. Okay. Good. And so you see that this depends only on the form of the distribution of spacing, of level spacing, depends only on the symmetry, very general symmetry of the quantum system. In general case, we have beta equal 2. In some case, we have beta equal 1. And in some subcase, we have beta equal 4. Okay? And in fact, this works amazingly well. Because, so I don't have time, and I didn't have time to prepare a nice picture, but this universality has been checked in many, many systems. This distribution has been checked first in the systems originated by Wigner, namely energy level in some, not all, heavy nuclei. Well, not so heavy, but not the polonium or those transuranian elements, but some not so light nuclei. For some nuclei, or some isotopes of some, you can check, you can measure many, many energy levels by doing experiments of scatterings, neutron scatterings from, for instance, or on the nuclei, or electron scattering on the nuclei. And you may look at the spectrum. You find a very, very complicated spectrum. You measure the distribution of the distance between energy, the level spacing, and you find a curve which fits with one of those curves. And you have nuclei which have one symmetry or do not have the symmetry. For instance, it depends on the ratio of the number of neutrons and the number of protons, whether it's even or it's odd, things like that. So you can check both. Okay, so this works well. This doesn't work for all nuclei, of course. There are some nuclei or some region. There may be very well be some region in the spectrum when you have this kind of behavior and some region where it doesn't work. Okay? Now, it works well also for what is called chaotic quantum systems. Namely, systems whose classical dynamics is chaotic. And it's a very active area of theoretical physics to understand what characterized a quantum system whose classical analog is chaotic, because it's easy to characterize what chaos. Well, it's not easy. It has been it took several decades, starting from Poincaré up to Kolmogorov, then to Kolmogorov, etc., and to Sinai and many, many great minds to understand what chaoticity means in a classical system. But in a quantum system, we do not really now we understand what it is. But one can say, for instance, that quantum dynamics is linear because it's given by the evolution equation of an operator. Why classical dynamics is non-linear in general? If the classical dynamics is linear, it's an integrable system and it's not chaotic. Okay. So what does it mean for a quantum system to be chaotic? That's a difficult question. It's one now has some good idea of what's going on, but the problem is not completely solved. OK, but one example of a chaotic system is the following one. You take a rectangle, and you put an electron on it. OK, so it's a classical particle will behave like that. And it's a perfectly, if you want, integrable system. You know, it reflects, so that's a system which is quite regular. It's a non-chaotic system. Solving the quantum system of one particle in a rectangle is an exercise one is doing in first year of learning of quantum mechanics. And one knows the spectrum, and one knows that the spectrum is given by the energy level as given by the sum over some n squared with some number plus m squared, some other number. The energy level are characterized by two numbers, okay, with A and B related to the dimension of the rectangle. And that's a spectrum which is perfectly regular. Okay? And if you, for such a spectrum like that, if you want to compute if you want to compute you can compute, of course, the distribution law for the spacing, and you find something completely different. You find the law which is like that, which is called, in that case, the Poisson distribution. It's this distribution probability, which is known since two centuries in probability theory. And it's very different from the Wigner distribution, in particular, because you have a finite probability to have a very small spacing between two levels, because basically the levels are completely independent from each other. While here, you have a repulsion between the levels. You see, the levels don't like to be close together. Okay. So now, let us, instead of taking a triangle, add two half circles to make it a stadium. And this is called the Bunimovich stadium. Okay? Then if you take a particle which propagates in the classical level, it becomes complicated because it's happening non-trivial things in, when you reach the extremity of the stadium. And if you take a very nearby initial point, well, as long as you are in the triangles, they don't change. But here, remember, it's curved. So it's, it starts to go like that. So it starts to be different. Here, it's completely different. And after some time, the classical trajectory are completely different. So this means that, in fact, the classical dynamics is ergodic. And not only it is ergodic, but there is what is called an exponential divergence of the trajectory. If you take two nearby initial condition and you look at what are the final condition, where are the particles, they are at a distance which behaves, which grows exponentially with the time. Well, until you reach the side of the stadium where the particle is confined. But for small distances between the particle which are large with respect to the difference of the initial condition, the distance between two initial conditions grows exponentially with time. Okay? And that's one of the characterizations of what is called the chaotic behavior. Well, it's called, well, there are different definitions. In fact, there are different kinds of chaos, and that's one type of chaos. Okay? So now you can look at the eigens, you can quite easily, in fact, diagonalize the Heisenberg equation in this system. Okay, and look at the eigenvalues of the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which is here just 1/2 n times the Laplacian, with so you, h is just it's a free particle. Okay, and you have just what is called the wave function has to be equal to zero on the boundary. So you solve, you find the eigenvalues of the Laplacian on this stadium with a boundary condition, which means that the wave function has to vanish outside of the stadium. And you find a spectrum which looks like that, and you plug the energy level, you find precisely the Wigner distribution. Okay? And it's not fully completely proved why this is worked. It's quite natural, but yes?
Can you solve it exactly?
Numerically, yes. You can solve it numerically. There are some cases where there are some numerical. One was that there is some algebra. It's a wide field. You know, it has been studied since many, many years. So it started with the conjecture by people in Orsay, Boydas, Giannoni, and Michael Berry has contributed a lot to this subject. There is a connection with many, many aspects of mathematics called like trace formula, for those of you who are familiar with that. Okay, so you see there is a deep connection between random matrices and chaotic quantum systems. Okay, there is an even more puzzling relation, I will have to stop, which is that if you look at the distribution of the zeros of the zeta, of Riemann zeta function, the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, which is a very important function in mathematics, which has, and there is a, so it's a function which is depends on the eigenvalues, and there is a conjecture which was made by Riemann that it's an analytic function, that it has its zeros on the imaginary axis with real part 1/2. And up to now, it's a conjecture. It's called the Riemann conjecture. And if you solve it, you will be famous. And I think in addition, you will earn $1 million of US dollars. It's one of the Quay prizes, yeah. And it's basically one of the few remaining great conjectures of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, which remains to this. The Poincaré conjecture has been solved. The Fermat theorem has been solved. The Riemann conjecture has not been, or the Riemann theorem has not been solved. And it has very, very important consequences in mathematics and probably in physics too. And if you look at the, so you have eigenvalues which are probably on the real axis. And up to now, you know, all the eigenvalues that the people have been able to compute by numerical method lies on this line. Okay? So this leads some people to believe that there is a quantum system whose spectrum are the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. A chaotic system, very complicated, probably non-commutative, based on some non-commutative geometry. Based on that. But if you look at the distribution of distance between eigenvalues in the, or the zero, between the zeros of the zeta function, you find also a law similar to this one. Well, there are a few subtle differences, but there is a striking similarity with the Wigner distribution. Yes.
Can you
And it's still poorly understood. Many things are understood, but it's part of the Riemann of the theorem by Riemann. Okay, so I think I should end up there. But let me just finish with one remark. There is a connection, and a very, very deep one, between random matrices and let us say high energy physics, quantum gravity, and string theories. Okay. And I will just say one word about that. Remember the Feynman diagram we wrote for the U2 gauge theory. Okay. Remember that I use this representation of Toft to represent the Feynman diagram as so that the propagator were carrying colors. Okay, so we had a Feynman diagram like that when you had a Feynman. So I will draw one Feynman diagram of the, for instance, of the. Imagine that this is a photon, for example, which propagates, well, a gauge field. And you may very well have a diagram like that. Okay. Well, let us, I will draw this diagram. It will be better. Okay. You may have a diagram where you have different colors. Let us play with the colors. And I need four colors. Pink will be fine. Okay. This is one diagram, one possible diagram, with gluon interacting and propagating. And now imagine that you, instead of having, now I have, here at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different colors. So this means that this diagram, if the color is different, is not a U2 gauge theory. It will be at least a U5 gauge theory. So in fact, one can consider UN gauge theories. And for UN gauge theory, you simply have N different colors. Okay, the Feynman rules are exactly the same, except that you have N different colors. So look at this diagram like that, for instance. When you count the contribution of this diagram, this color is fixed, this color is fixed, but this color is free, this color is free, this color is free. So these diagrams come with a factor n to the power 3. And these diagrams come with a coupling constant g here, 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 here. So this diagram comes with a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six. And diagram. Okay, now let us consider the same diagram where we have now this. Okay, but I have, now what I will have is that I will have something like that. And a diagram. Okay. This is, imagine that those two propagators cross each other. You see? This is a diagram where you can have only n colors. Because if this propagator carries a green color, then the green color goes along the three loops of the diagram. Okay? You see? But an important difference, this diagram is planar in the sense that it can be drawn on a blackboard, and this diagram is non-planar. You see? And you see that these diagrams goes with a factor n which is smaller than this one. And in fact, Toft, Gerhard Toft, in 74, made a beautiful remark. He remarked that in the limit when n goes to infinity, so the number of colors becomes very, very large, while in fact, and you have to rescale the coupling constant, in fact, you must g times n squared has to be finite. So the coupling is n goes to zero infinity, and the coupling constant goes to zero at the same rate. Only the planar diagrams survive. And there are much less planar diagrams in the quantum field theory than general Feynman diagrams. So this leads to very, very a great simplification of the theory. And also, it's, if you have a diagram which are planars, it suggests that there is some connection with strings, because the degrees of freedom propagate on some surfaces. So this suggested the connection between gauge theories and strings theories. It also suggested a suggestion between quantum theory, because summing over Feynman, planar Feynman diagrams means summing over triangulation on some surface. And summing over triangulation of a surface, or summing over all the diagram you can draw on a surface, on a planar plane, means, in some loose sense, summing over all the two-dimensional Riemann matrix you can put on the surface. You see? So studying a gauge theory with a large number of colors is related to the problem of summing over matrix, two-dimensional matrix, so in relation with quantum gravity in 2D. And it's also related to many problems in string theories. And there has been an amazing number of development. There are still a lot of things going on using this idea. Okay. So I hope to have interested you and show you that there are not only Feynman diagrams in quantum field theory, but also that Feynman diagrams can be very, very rich and very interesting, and are connected to a lot of other problems of physics. Okay, thank you.
Matrix and do something to it, that would make all of the entries real, because the realtor is a subset.
Yes.
And then you could just stick that into quantum mechanics and use it.
Yes.
Because the real matrix is a complex matrix.
Yes.
But it seems as though a quaternion matrix is not a complex matrix in general. So how would you stick that into your...
It's a bit technical. I'm not sure I have all the details in mind.
Okay.
But complex, it's not really... it's not exactly quaternionic matrices. It's matrices which satisfy some symmetry related to the SL2M group. So in fact, invariant symmetric matrices are matrices which are invariant. Well, trace of M squared for a matrix which is symmetric are invariant under the OM symmetric group. Group of rotation. You can change M into O M O transpose, where O is the matrix of the O M group. If the matrix is real, okay, for a real case. In the complex case, you are studying matrix distribution invariant under the low M goes to U M U dagger. Okay, and for symplectic matrices, you are studying matrix ensemble which are invariant under S M S dagger. Here U, so O belongs to the orthogonal group, U belongs to the unitary group, and S belongs to the symplectic SL M.
Okay. SLN is special linear N, which is?
Pardon? Yeah, SLN bar, yes. So when this is becoming to start technical. Okay, so in fact, the symmetry here, the set of random matrices is symmetric, is invariant under transformation related to symplectic transformation. Okay, but that's a technical one. But you can find that in, I can give you references. They are connected to quaternions in some way. But those are not exactly matrices whose elements are quaternions. Okay.
For giving us such an inspiring lecture, series of lectures on quantum field theory, this is a token of our gratitude. Ah. Membership to the side of
okay, thank you very much. Thank you. And I wish you a great future in physics.
Thank you.